Okay, I'm starting the webinar.
Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, depending upon the time zone you're in, and welcome. My name is Alex Siegel. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of the Republican Jewish Coalition, and I want to thank everybody for joining us today for what is sure to be a very robust conversation led by the Jewish Policy Center's Senior Director, Shoshana Bryan, and our special guest, Professor Eugene Kantorovich. And so before we get started, I just want to get a couple housekeeping items out of the way for the RJC, particularly our upcoming meetings. We have a national meeting in Washington, D.C., headlined by Senator Dave McCormick and House Republican Conference Chairwoman Lisa McClain. That's on June 12th in Washington, D.C. And of course, our annual summit in Las Vegas, Halloween weekend this year, October 31st to November 2nd. So please mark your calendar for both of those events, and we hope to see you there. And finally, before I pass the floor to Shoshana, I of course want to wish everybody a kosher and joyous Passover. And so I hope everybody who's traveling gets to their destination safely and has a wonderful Pesach. So with that, I will pass the floor to the Jewish Policy Center Senior Director, Shoshana Bryan. For those who are not aware, Shoshana leads the RJC's 501c3 sister organization, and is just an absolute rock star in that space. She leads, or she's the editor of the In Focus quarterly magazine that the JPC puts out. And we're lucky that she's a member of our team. So with that, Shoshana, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for the nice introduction. I'm really pleased to have been invited by the RJC to host this webinar with Professor Eugene Kantorovich, a truly amazing scholar and writer. He's a professor of law, having received his undergraduate and law degrees from the University of Chicago. He is director of the Center for the Middle East and International Law at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia School of Law. He's also a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom. He hangs with all the best people. He is also the head of the International Law Department of the Kohelet Policy Forum in Israel. His commentary and analysis appears everywhere you think it should, Wall Street Journal, Atlantic, Tablet, and he is a frequent TV contributor. I am surprised that he found time to spend an hour with us, and I am thrilled. Eugene, I want to start in two places generally not on the radar of Jewish organizations, Greenland and Panama. I do that because sometimes the Jewish world is a little bit narrow, and mostly we are concerned with Israel and the future of the Jewish people. But the world is bigger, wider, and more dangerous than that. So we have to have a wider viewfinder. So, Greenland, it sounded like a joke when President Trump suggested that the U.S. buy the island, but it isn't a joke. Tell us why it isn't a joke.
So first of all, the United States has extremely serious interests in Greenland. It has an Air Force base there for a long time. And Greenland, because of its location, is actually crucial to several strategic considerations, in particular ballistic missile defense, because of the orbits the missiles have to take, as well as controlling the Atlantic. And recently, Russia has become increasingly aggressive in intruding on the Atlantic, which of course is really America's backyard, given the location of Alaska. And so control of the Arctic is crucial. It's perhaps one of the easiest ways to get from one side of the world to the other. Control of the airspace in which ballistic missiles fly is crucial. And there are also various minerals there that are thought to be particularly important. Now, why is all that important? Because right now it is part of the sovereign kingdom of Denmark, which is not bad in itself, but it is a significant question whether Denmark can actually patrol and police all these spaces against Russian and potentially Chinese encroachment. What's even more potentially concerning, and I think why the issue is potentially ripe now in the president's mind, is Denmark is going through some kind of colonial guilt process and have an idea of making Greenland, giving Greenland independence. Now, if Denmark, only can field two dog sled squads, I kid you not, that's what they have in Greenland. Greenland, with a population of 50,000, is completely it's completely impossible for them to maintain a genuine independence. That is to say, they can have a nominal status as a sovereign state, but would certainly be easy to put under the thumb of a much less scrupulous power than the United States, like Russia or China. America cannot allow that to happen, which is why extending America's protective umbrella is very crucial. And there's, not a clear path to that, but there's many potential ways. I think when the president speaks of buying Greenland, he means either from the Kingdom of Denmark or potentially from the people themselves. That is to say, to make them basically a better offer on their on their shares. Something I think he understands as a businessman. But I think the underlying point is it is too important to leave inadequately defended.
Which is probably also true of the next place I want to go,
Yes.
which also doesn't pop up at too many Passover seders. Let's go to Panama. And again, the U.S. has legitimate legal interests in what happens there. Tell us about them.
Right. So Panama is in a sense an easier case. Because the Denmark Greenland is really just part of Denmark, and other than having an air base there, America doesn't have any kind of additional particular arrangements. But Panama, the Panama Canal, was constructed by the United States and was run as a de facto part of the United States for quite a long time. Speaking of Republicans, I believe Senator John McCain was born there. It was an area in which Americans lived. And was controlled by the United States because it basically controls access from one hemisphere to the other, one half of the world to the other, the Atlantic to the Pacific, and is absolutely crucial for both commercial and military purposes. Now, 1977, Jimmy Carter decided to give away the Panama Canal with American troops leaving 20 years later, and the Panama Canal Zone being reincorporated into Panama. That was a very controversial decision at the time. A lot of people in the Senate thought it was nuts, and so many restrictions were put on that giveaway. That is to say, in the treaty made with Panama, Panama pledged to maintain the permanent neutrality of the canal, which included not putting it under the control of any foreign power. Now, since then, a variety of Chinese companies have been given contracts to run or build facilities around, and in some cases over, the canal, which give them, in many ways, a strong position to control the canal. Now, those are not some of those are Chinese government companies, others are Chinese private companies, but in a communist country with a national security law that requires companies to basically help the military when necessary, there's not much of a distinction. And there are many, many thousands, maybe even tens of thousands of Chinese workers who live in kind of closely guarded camps all around the canal. And it's anybody's guess what their real agenda is. So the president is saying that the canal has basically been put under the control, in part, of a foreign power. And that's a very serious legal argument. And the treaty has a very clear method for determining what happened, for determining whether there's a violation. Each side decides for itself if the treaty is being upheld. Which means the United States can decide the treaty is being violated, and the United States can then take steps. And the treaty allows, which is quite unusual, we don't have this with Denmark. The treaty allows clearly intervention and military force to end violations. In other words, to again, enforce the neutrality of the canal and remove it from Chinese influence. Now, that would obviously be a big last-ditch step. But in the meantime, the president seems to be using that to get Panama to shed some of these Chinese contracts, with which there's already been some success.
So now we've got Greenland and Panama, and we're going to inch our way back to areas that are more familiar to us. Let's start with Hungary. So Hungary has withdrawn from the International Criminal Court, ostensibly over its demand that Budapest arrest Prime Minister Netanyahu on his visit. First, before we get to the real questions, can you explain the difference between the ICC, and the International Court of Justice, the ICJ? I suspect that a lot of our listeners, aside from believing that both are prejudiced against Israel, don't really know which to worry about more. Where should we be most concerned?
They pose different kinds of concerns, but probably the ICC is the bigger problem. So the ICJ is an older organization. It's actually part of the United Nations. It's the judicial arm of the United Nations. First of all, I should say none of these courts can be properly called what they're sometimes called in the press, a world court. None of them are that. They're both international treaty organizations with some power, but not all power. So the ICJ is an institution that hears disputes between countries. So the parties are always two countries, except when it issues advisory opinions. So it's one country bringing a claim against another country. So in this case, it's South Africa versus Israel, and it only has jurisdiction when countries agree to give it jurisdiction. Now, it used to be like the original idea of the UN was that countries would issue these statements, declarations, giving the ICJ jurisdiction over any dispute they have with any country. Because of lots of problems with the ICJ and countries not wanting to give up their sovereignty, there are very few countries of any great import that have these declarations now, and the ICJ jurisdiction has been declining. It can also hear disputes where a particular treaty that a country signs gives it jurisdiction. And in this case, that treaty is the Genocide Convention, which has a provision saying that disputes will be decided by the ICJ. Now, when Israel signed this in 1954, I believe, it never thought it could be used this way, right? This was designed to protect Jews against genocide. And in particular, it couldn't be used this way because when we say dispute between countries, we normally think of normal cases like Ukraine versus Russia, they're accusing each other, Serbia versus Croatia, Ethiopia, Eritrea, they're accusing each other of genocide. In this case, the plaintiff is a country with really no relation to the conduct at all. We can talk more about that if you want. But South Africa basically has found some a pretext to bring a case against against Israel, which really should be outside of the jurisdiction of the ICJ, and certainly would not qualify for standing in any American court. What they did basically is again, the treaty says disputes about the Genocide Convention, and South Africa wrote a letter to Israel saying, "We believe you're committing genocide in Gaza." And the Israeli foreign minister wrote actually a fairly considered answer saying, "No, we don't believe so, and here's why." And then South Africa took those two letters and said, "Look, there's a dispute about the Genocide Convention, even though it's not one that affects South Africa in any particular material way." What this really means is that anytime now that this jurisdictional trick has been invented, anytime Israel has a war, there will be a genocide convention case about it, right? Because the real allegations is there's a war, some civilians are getting killed, and thus genocide. So any war is likely to any land war certainly is likely to meet those standards, and that means this is going to be a perpetual sword hanging over Israel's head. There is something, of course, Israel could do about it. It could do what America did. When America joined the Genocide Convention several decades later, it actually made a reservation, which is a limitation on the Genocide Convention. It said, "We agree to the Genocide Convention except for that part about ICJ jurisdiction." And many other countries have such reservations. Israel, of course, was naive. But that could still be done. It's a little bit procedurally tricky. But that's definitely something to consider. Now, in terms of what the ICJ can do, The ICJ has jurisdiction over countries and it issues orders saying you should do this, you should do that, directed at the government of the country. In cases involving ongoing military operations, those orders have, in all cases, ICJ preliminary orders have a compliance rate of under 50%, which is remarkable given that both parties had to agree to the ICJ. In the past a few decades, the compliance rate with orders involving ongoing military conflict has been very close to zero. But of course, Israel is different. And the idea is that the ICJ proceeding would be a basis then, if there's a negative findings about Israel, would be a basis for going to the Security Council for critical condemnatory action and maybe even sanctions. And that's kind of the idea. Now, one might think with President Trump, there's nothing to worry about with the Security Council. But given the ICJ cases typically drag on for 5, 10, even 15 years, it's kind of a sword hanging over Israel's head until the ICJ is maybe reformed or disciplined. Now, the ICC is a much newer thing. It is created in 2001, and it is a court that tries crimes. It is a criminal court, and so the cases are not against countries. The cases are prosecutions of the ICC versus individuals. Now, it only has jurisdiction over countries that have joined. Now, about half the countries in the world have joined. Most people in the world live in countries that have not joined. That is to say, India, China, United States, Russia, the major powers of the world have not joined because they don't trust the ICC. Now, like America, Israel has not joined. So they had to invent a whole new country in order to seek to exercise jurisdiction over Israel. Namely, they invented a state of Palestine and claimed that it joined. So the ICC is different in that, in some senses, it's less scary because it's not against the country. On the other hand, maybe it's worse because it's criminal and they can, in fact, arrest people and they have a jail. Now, to put it in perspective, in their 20-some years of operation, they have convicted 6 people for the atrocity crimes that they have jurisdiction over. 6 is not a lot when you're spending $300 million a year, which is about what their budget is. That's 6 people total. Most of them were... It has also managed successfully to prosecute 0 incumbent leaders. Now, part of that is because typical defendants are dictators, and dictators don't give up power willingly or, while alive. So this new idea of going after democratically elected officials is actually a powerful idea for the ICC because, at some point they leave office and maybe are less well positioned to protect themselves.
So you wrote in 2024, I think, that the House of Representatives passed a bill to impose sanctions against officials of the ICC if it put out arrest warrants against Israeli officials. Well, it did that. Karim Khan applied for warrants based on war crimes allegations against Prime Minister Netanyahu and then Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. Do you know what the current status of the legal case against Israel is? And whether the U.S. House of Representatives has tried to impose any sanctions on the ICC?
So the case against Israel is at the stage where a warrant has been issued and confirmed by the court. Obviously, Prime Minister Netanyahu has not been arrested and is unlikely to turn himself over. So basically, there's just a pending warrant. Israel has appealed that warrant, but I think that's unlikely to succeed. And so there are many, many cases that are stuck at this point because, again, the ICC has no police and so really no way to arrest people other than through the cooperation of member states. But again, the idea of this is not necessarily to bring Prime Minister Netanyahu to trial, though they'd be very happy with that also. The process is the punishment. The idea is to have this thing constantly hanging over Israel's head. And I have to say, it's a huge success for Palestinian diplomacy. That is to say, they pursued a strategy to get membership in first to have the United Nations General Assembly refer to them as a state, to use that to bootstrap it into membership in the ICC, and then bring this case. And now that they pushed for this investigation, it is like a perpetual diplomatic headache for Israel. I point this out because it's something they did a very good job at, and we should kind of learn from this thinking of creating a fundamentally new reality. They created a new reality, now we live in it. Whereas typically we don't really create realities, we have temporary diplomatic responses. So the sanctions, Senator Schumer blocked this bill from advancing in the Senate. It did not become law.
Ah.
And so the bill to allow for sanctions on the ICC is unlikely to become law, at least in the short term. However, President Trump made an executive order sanction, which allowing for sanctions on the ICC, as he did, by the way, in his first term also. That order was canceled by President Biden on his first day. So President Trump has now made an executive order allowing for sanctions on ICC personnel who bring cases against non-member states. So far, they have only sanctioned one person, which is the prosecutor, which is probably not enough. But there is some kind of process going on in the administration to consider more people to sanction. In my view, the administration needs to be extremely aggressive and sanction, very broadly within the ICC and those who help the ICC, because the ICC thinks their strategy is going to be try to wait out President Trump. So if only some people on the prosecution team are sanctioned, Europe will allow them to set up some kind of special bank accounts, and they will ride it out. Only if really the institutions apparat, if the staff of the institution is sanctioned in a way that prevents it from functioning, will the goal of these sanctions be accomplished. And I think it's important to know the ICC is not democratically elected. They're going to be there forever. In their view, right? Nobody fires them. And they're looking at Netanyahu and Trump, and they say these guys will be gone in a few years, and we will be able to work with the future administration to nab these guys. And I think it's very likely that President Trump would face charges against the ICC under a Democratic administration, and that the charges against Prime Minister Netanyahu and potentially many other Israeli officials would be much harder for Israel to defend from in a different administration, which is why it's really crucial that the administration not sort of settle for just gestures at sanctioning the ICC, but really once you take a shot, you have to really go all the way.
What you described about creating a country and creating facts on the ground that are going to have to be lived with. I have to say that the Palestinians and their supporters in Europe and in the United States and elsewhere, they've done a very good job of that, but they've also done it a very good job with media. And Israel finds itself now responding to bizarre allegations, hideous allegations, all over social media and even in the mainstream media. And I worry that Israel hasn't quite figured out how to deal with it yet. And I don't know if they will. That's one of the difficult things. But moving on to things in the ICC. So Khan decided to make it look like there was some balance in the ICC, and he made similar charges to the ones against Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant against Yahya Sinwar and Ismail Haniyeh, both of whom are dead. So, and I think they were dead when the charges were leveled. I'm not sure, but I think they were already. So what happens then? I mean, it's just over because they're dead, so it's over.
Yeah, they charge three. I mean, the charges, I'd say, are different in a very fundamental way. The thing that Netanyahu is accused of doing simply just didn't happen. That is to say, it's in some sense, it's worse than a blood libel, because in a blood libel, typically Jews would be accused of killing a Christian child and using the blood for matzah. However, the Christian child would, in fact, be dead. Someone else killed him or died, whatever. Died in an accident, there would often be a dead Christian child. In this case, the accusation is starvation of the Palestinian population. And there's just not a starved population. Right? It's not clear that anyone has died of starvation, let alone because of lack of food in Gaza. Obviously, Hamas controls the actual distribution of food in Gaza. So they indicted three people: Sinwar, and also the Mohamed Deif. They indicted. They're all three dead now, which means that Israel has closed more ICC cases in a few months than I think the ICC closes in a decade, which again shows the uselessness of the ICC. Now, for a long time, the ICC refused to close the case against Mohamed Deif, hoping that he would be found alive under the rubble, because then they lose this balance. And so there was this weird thing for an international court of they were doing this weekend at Bernie's thing and pretending Mohamed Deif was alive until it became kind of impossible to pretend. So now the investigation is solely focused out on Israeli officials, and the prosecutor has made clear that he might actually add to the list of Israeli officials, which again, I think it's not surprising that the Hamas guys died, were killed by Israel. When you look at ICC defendants, a very large number of them, do not die of natural causes and die, without the ICC being able to get their hands on them, because these are people who are taking actions in the context of a war, ethnic struggle, and they're all in. They're all in. So by the time they've done whatever bad thing, they're like Gaddafi would have was indicted by the ICC. He would have loved for the ICC to get their hands on him, because that would mean his enemies wouldn't get their hands on him and tear him to pieces. So people who are war criminals or perpetrators of great atrocities, they're high risk individuals, right? By the time they've done whatever they've done to get themselves on the radar of the ICC, they have already accepted a very high likelihood of death, which they balance against getting to be a big leader in chief if they prevail in the struggle. The only way the ICC can ever get their hands on them is if they lose whatever war they're in. So for them, the ICC doesn't add any deterrent capability, right? You're Sinwar, you do October 7th, Israel is going to come for you and try to kill you. So if your war is not successful, if Israel is not, forced to give up by Biden, then Israel will probably hunt you down and kill you. And if they don't, then you're going to be the head of Gaza and nobody's going to be able to touch you. So it adds no extra negative thing. If you're the leader of a Western democracy, you think, look, I'm fighting this war not for my own power. I'm going to, be out of power in a couple years anyway. Why should I bear all the cost? So potentially, and we haven't seen this with Netanyahu, but what we see is this kind of so-called equal treatment. It can only deter Western democracies from vigorously defending themselves against attacks from illiberal actors like Hamas.
Well, as you say, this will haunt Israel for a long time. And I assume that not just Israel, but at some point Israel's government will change. There will be a new prime minister. There's already a new defense minister. Those crimes can be moved down to those people as well. So it presents an ongoing and forever problem as long as the world sees a, or at least the court sees, a state of Palestine as a legitimate player.
But President Trump has a real opportunity here. He can close down the ICC.
How?
If he, with sanctions,
Yes.
if he sanctions the ICC the way President Biden sanctioned the movement that was protesting aid to Hamas, the way President Biden sanctioned farmers in Judea and Samaria, and the way he sanctioned construction companies building in Judea and Samaria. There was a group called Hashomer Yosh, which provided guards for far guards for farms in Judea and Samaria. These are typically single family farms, so when they go to sleep, all their sheep wind up stolen. So they provide guards. That organization was sanctioned and had to close down very quickly. It can be done to them. It could be done to the ICC, and I think it's very important to communicate to the administration that it's not the act of sanctioning that's important, but really the end result. So long as the ICC is still standing, they will come back only sort of angrier from this.
Tell us, I was going to ask you this later, but tell us now. What were some of the sanctions that Biden imposed on the organization? How deeply did he get into their pockets?
The Biden administration, in the course of basically 1 year, their last year, the first of they announced a sanctions policy targeted at Israelis, the first foreign sanctions policy targeted at Israelis as opposed to Libya, Syria, etc. They sanctioned about 30 something people and organizations. Many of those organizations basically had to shut down. And the people faced extreme hardship. Finally, I think the biggest organization he sanctioned was Amana, which builds homes in Judea and Samaria. And that was a big blow for them, but that was already towards the end. And if President Trump had not been elected, then clearly it would have been very difficult for them to survive. Now, I think it's important to understand that the next Democratic administration is going to start where this one left off. Right? That is to say, they're going to start with sanctions on basically anyone doing anything in Judea and Samaria, followed by sanctions on the army and Israeli government ministers. They're going to use these sanctions to do what hopefully, what Trump should be doing with the ICC. They're going to try to shut it down. And we're not, there's not going to be an election a few days away. So the stakes these days are very high.
Okay, we may get back to that a little bit later, but let's move on and see. Now we're moving into the region. Let's go to Egypt. I'm actually fairly sympathetic to President el-Sisi's fear of the Muslim Brotherhood Hamas infiltration of Egypt, particularly Muslim Brotherhood entry into Cairo. They were, after all, the ones who killed Sadat, and they have been responsible for wreckage in the northern Sinai. So the problem here for Israel is the Philadelphia corridor. Can you start there, please, and tell us why Israel needs to control it? And what happened before 10/7? I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on at Philadelphia before 10/7, and Egypt
Yeah,
was responsible for some of it.
so I'm less sympathetic to Egypt because, as you say, they helped create this monster that they're now afraid of. The Philadelphia Corridor is basically the strip, the southern strip of the Gaza Strip, the edge between Gaza and Egypt, and without controlling that frontier. Things can move basically across from Gaza into Egypt, either above ground or underground. And that seems to be where Hamas got most of its arms, its equipment to build the tunnels. So everybody always knew that the Philadelphia Corridor was crucial. In 2005, when Israel undertook the really horrendous disengagement from Gaza, they understood that Hamas, that the Philadelphia Corridor had to be kept out of Gazan control, and so they
Keep in mind, let me just interrupt you for a second, that it was the Palestinian Authority to whom they were giving
correct
it, and not Hamas, and that's going to come later and screw things up even
yeah
further.
and they understood that even the they should not be controlling it because weapons will come in, and so they created a they made a deal with Europe, which was so excited about the disengagement, that they would create a basically international observer force that would inspect everything going through and would stand at the border and at the Rafah crossing and Philadelphia Corridor and monitor things to make sure bad stuff is not coming in. So EUFOR, I think it was called. Anyway, that force did not last long because as soon as Hamas was elected a year later, they showed up at these checkpoints and told these guys, "Get out of here." Now, instead of saying, "No, we have a duty. We have to make sure weapons don't come in. This is our job. We won't abandon our position," they promptly fled. So Israel understands that without Israeli control of that area, it would simply be another, Hamas would rearm in another 20 years, if not sooner.
Now, since 10/7, one of the things I think a lot of people have overlooked is that Egypt has worked to close the border with Gaza, finally, and not to permit Palestinians to seek refuge from the war, although I'm not sure the smuggling stopped. But they closed the border. Palestinians had been using that as an exit point to Europe and to other places. Is it not a violation of international humanitarian law to shut the border in the middle of a war and keep refugees from trying to escape the war?
Yeah, absolutely. It is a clear violation of international law. Egypt has an obligation under the Refugee Convention to take these refugees. Basically, President Biden treated Gaza's border with Egypt the way he should have treated the American southern border. It's okay, close the border,
Close the border.
and vice versa. In this is the only conflict, right? In the war with Syria, millions of refugees in the Syrian civil war, tens of millions of refugees. Ukrainian war, millions of refugees have gone to Europe, but barely a soul has been able to leave Gaza. And of course, that just exacerbates the situation inside Gaza. So, in a sense, by not letting people leave, they exacerbate the humanitarian situation, which is part of the point, right? That is to say, these people are human shields in a couple levels, right? Both on a tactical level, where Hamas is actively hiding behind them, and also Hamas, in case they don't want to be human shields and want to run away from Gaza, they're being trapped inside by Egypt and Hamas.
And then blaming it on Israel, because
Correct.
at the
And
end of
any
the
bad
day,
consequences that ensue.
at the end of the day, it is often Israeli ammunition that takes them out, and that is sad, but it's because those guys won't step up and do what they're supposed to. But in the meantime, Egypt has stepped up its military presence in the Sinai. This is a violation of the Camp David Accords, although I think Israel is probably not worried about an Egyptian invasion of Israel right now. But what do you see in that stepping up of the military presence in Sinai? Is it Egypt's intention to just make sure that stays closed and nobody gets across?
I mean, it could be an implicit. I think there's a few levels. It's in part an implicit threat to Israel. If you try to get Gazans, if you try to implement the Trump plan, if you try to get Gazans out, we're willing to go all the way, which shows you it's not much of a peace treaty. And also, it is also just to keep the Gazans in.
Okay. So, although the
Both.
more you hear from the Gazans, the more you hear they'd like to get out. So I'm
Well,
not
I mean,
sure.
we don't even need to hear from them. If they didn't want to leave, they wouldn't need Egypt wouldn't need to seal them in.
That's
Right? If
true.
they didn't want to leave, you could have an open border. They would just happily stay.
Wow.
You
I
only
don't.
have to not let people leave if they want to go.
But at the same time, European officials and pro-Hamas people, including that social media presence, they are asserting that President Trump's proposal to move them constitutes an addition to genocide, but more importantly, from their point of view, ethnic cleansing. It is ethnic cleansing because it's their space. I have two problems here, one of which you've already addressed, which is that Syrian refugees have gone out and Ukrainian refugees have gone out, and you know they have to go out. But also, how can it be? These are people who claim to be Palestinians. They claim that Gaza is a Palestinian state, and yet they are refugees. And one of the reasons that they don't want, other people don't want President Trump to move them is because he's moving refugees and denying refugees their refuge. Shouldn't they be citizens of something if they're living in what they think is the Palestinian state?
Yeah, how can they be refugees from if they're already refugees? The double refugee thing is definitely strange. But again, that's just because the Palestinian refugees have a unique refugee status, which is not really refugee status. So actually, under the UNRWA rules of the status of being a Palestinian refugee, it makes you ineligible for becoming a regular refugee. But it just shows the several levels of unreality here, yeah, for sure.
Wait, what's a regular refugee?
A refugee under the human rights, under the refugee treaty. So for the Palestinian refugee, for the Palestinian refugees, that title is a unique status that is different from the worldwide refugee definition and was
And
created by UNRWA specifically for the Palestinians.
And that's what allows them to pass it from generation to generation, where
That's,
no
yeah,
one else
part, it
does.
has several unique features. It has just, its content is different from the general one. It's hereditary. Interestingly, it's hereditary only patrilineally.
Ah, okay. Which should keep Palestinian women marrying Palestinian men so that
Exactly.
their children. Okay. I hadn't known about something called UNKRA, UNKRA. Do you know about UNKRA?
What's UNCRA?
Well, it doesn't exist anymore. It's the UN Korea Refugee Relief Association. It was created after the Korean War, 1952. I think it was created, and the ceasefire came in 1953. And UNRWA had the same mandate, original mandate, and it's gone because the original mandate for both was to settle Korean people and Arab people in the places they could settle, and they did it with the Koreans, and they didn't do it with the Arabs. And I just didn't realize that the UN had, in fact, been successful in dealing with some of these strange things.
Yeah, because the point of UNRWA is not to close down. The point of UNRWA is to be perpetual.
Ah, but the original point of UNRWA was to settle them. And we had American diplomats working in the Middle East trying to find places for these people to settle. And only
Oh,
later
fascinating.
did they turn it over to the Palestinians. It wasn't run by them in the beginning.
Right.
UNKRA wasn't run by Koreans either.
Interesting.
But now we've got what we've got. And one would hope that somebody would defund it and move them to UNHCR and settle them. You wrote about terra nullius in international law, specifically that Gaza is one of the few pieces of land in the world that is not under the sovereignty of any nation. Why is that sovereignty vacuum important? What does that mean for Israel?
So the sovereignty vacuum means a few things. One thing it means that is one thing it means is that there's a Gaza is not a country. It's not part of any country. That's a fairly unusual situation these days. One thing it means is that the laws of occupation, it cannot be subject to belligerent occupation. Under the Geneva Conventions, a territory can only be occupied. Only territory of a party to the Geneva Convention. Now, when Israel took control of Gaza and Judea and Samaria in 1967, it pointed out that they were not part of the territory. They were not under the sovereignty of Jordan and Egypt, respectively. They had just been occupied by those countries. And so the Geneva Convention should not apply. Now, the counter-argument that was developed in part by the State Department under Jimmy Carter and articulated in a legal memo there was, okay, it doesn't matter that it's not technically under Egyptian sovereignty. It was taken during a war with Egypt, which is a sovereign country. And so it's good enough for close enough for government work. But here you have that the missing that crucial aspect of a conflict with a sovereign country, right? There's no Egypt here. So it's really just Gaza, which is not a country, and thus it's what's called a non-international armed conflict, and its laws of belligerent occupation don't apply, much like in a civil war. It also means that there's no country whose sovereign rights would be violated if some other country, if someone else, existing country, asserted sovereignty over it, which is relevant, of course, both to Israel and potentially the United States under the Trump-Gaza vision.
Very strange. Does this apply to the West Bank as well?
I would argue that the West Bank, I would argue Israel actually has a sovereign claim to it. So Israel is the difference, of course. Israel had one to Gaza also, because they were all part of the League of Nations mandate. The difference is the disengagement from Gaza in 2005, I think, could be construed as a as a way as a surrender of sovereign claims.
Which has not happened in Judea and Samaria.
Correct.
Okay, now you have been so efficient in answering the questions that I've put to you that we actually have time for that last question that I know you could spend an hour on this last question. I'm going to ask you not to do that. But we have time, so let's get to it. We're going to go to Judea and Samaria. And anyway, I feel like we should because we started in Greenland and Panama and we've worked our way to the Middle East and to Israel. So let's go to Judea and Samaria. You wrote, "To understand why Israel is not occupying the West Bank and why Russia is occupying Crimea, one has to know the rules of international law that establish the borders of newly formed states." You wrote an article with one of my very, very favorite people, Professor Avi Bell, entitled "Palestine, Uti Possidetis and the Borders of Israel." What's the premise in the short form?
The short form is to figure out the status of, let's say, Judea and Samaria. You have to know what were Israel's borders in 1967, and what were its borders in 1948. So let's start with 1948. So Israel was created in 1948. We all agree to that. Pretty uncontroversial. How do we figure out what its borders are? So a lot of people want to say there was a UN resolution, there was this, there was that. Those are very sort of local answers. But a lawyer would say, you have to look for what are the legally relevant facts, not just what are the facts, what are the legally relevant facts. And for that, you need to know what is the rule of law, what is the legal rule. And it turns out international law does not have so many rules. It does not have half as many rules as it's as international law professors say it has, but it does have a fairly clear, robust, and uniformly applied rule about the borders of newly created states, which it's just, you can see why international law would want to have a good rule for that, because international law is the law between countries. So you need to know where one country starts and where another country stops. And there's a fair amount of practice with it, because new countries are created not infrequently these days. That is to say, in the past 70 some years, the United Nations membership went from 53, I think, to 193. So it's a not uncommon thing. In brief, this rule of international law, which has been applied all around the world, and you can take your favorite new country and see, is that when you have a country that is newly created, not a new government for an existing country, but a newly created country, which would happen either because of, let's say, the collapse of a federal system, or imperial collapse, decolonization, cession, secession, simple divorce in the case of Czech Republic and Slovakia. The borders of a new country are going to be drawn exactly along the top, the administrative borders, the internal borders of the last top level administrative unit in that area. So, what is the top level administrative unit? In the United States, it's a state. In Canada, it's a province. In Germany, it's a land. It's now what this means, and that is the only rule you look at. You don't look at demographics, history, topography, because once you have multiple factors, you have a completely indeterminate rule. And the goal here is to have a quick, easy, right away. So even like in Latin America now, when they have, if they have border disputes, they will like actually look up, 16th century Spanish maps, colonial maps. Notably, you do not look at self-determination or anything like this, because again, self-determination only begs the question, what are the borders along which self-determination is being decided? Who's included in that question of self-determination? When you apply that to Israel, so what was there right before 1948? It's very clear. The League of Nations mandate, the mandate for Palestine. The mandate for Palestine is a top level administrative unit. There were many other League of Nations mandates, and each of those, the successor country, took on exactly jot for jot the borders of the previous mandate. That's the case of Lebanon, with Syria, with the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, with Iraq, all of which were previous mandatory states. And this is even the case when that includes a disgruntled ethnic minority that would rather be part of some other country, which was always the case, which was the case in all of those examples, except maybe in Jordan it was a majority. But Lebanon had a Sunni then majority minority, which was unhappy about being lumped in with a Christian majority. In Syria, everybody was unhappy. And in Iraq, the Kurds were very unhappy to be lumped in to a primarily Arab country. Nonetheless, unless there had been a prior partition, actual implemented partition, the borders are going to be the borders of the previous mandatory entity. And that rule is applied universally and everywhere except for the case of Israel. And if you apply that rule, that means upon its creation, Israel had sovereignty over Judea and Samaria. Immediately, of course, it was invaded and occupied by Jordan. But you mentioned Crimea. Crimea has been occupied by Russia now for more than a decade. So if in a few years God performs a miracle for the Ukrainians and they manage to oust Russia from Crimea, would anyone say that Ukraine's now occupying Crimea? That Ukrainians would be settlers if they live in Crimea? No. Even though right now in Crimea, nobody really wants the Ukrainians because everybody who was on Ukraine's side has already fled, as was the case, of course, in Judea and Samaria in 1948.
Gives you a whole new perspective on what's right and what's wrong, first of all, but also the way law is applied to Israel in ways that it isn't applied to other people. And that has to raise the question, and I'm not going to raise it, but it does beg the question of anti-Semitism and all of those other kinds of things. But we don't have 6 hours to do that part. And we are, in fact, coming to the end of the program. And people who listen to the Jewish Policy Center webinars and who watch me in my other incarnation know that my goal is to leave on a positive note. And so I try to ask a question, the answer to which will be positive. In this case, Eugene, I cannot think of a question, the answer to which you would give me is positive because we haven't had one yet. So I'm just going to ask you to leave our listeners after all of this with a positive thought for the afternoon or the evening, depending on where they live.
It will be Passover soon, and cleaning will be over. That's one positive thought.
That is.
But within our context, where it's an overwhelmingly positive and strong time for the Jewish people, for America, and for the state of Israel. We have gone from perhaps an administration that was most hostile to Israel ever, that did truly unprecedented things, like the sanctions. I think the sanctions were really, it was one of the quieter policies, but had the ability to completely bring the state of Israel to its knees, and was really treating Israel like a terror entity. From an administration that greatly constrained Israel's ability to defend itself, to an administration that is really, wants Israel to vigorously defend itself, does not micromanage any of the details, and simply wants Israel to win. I think it's such a wild swing, and we need to be extremely grateful, but we also need to use that time to achieve permanent gains that are difficult to reverse.
I'll take it. That is positive enough for me. And so as we go out, I want to wish everybody not only Chag Pesach Sameach, but also Shabbat Shalom, because we probably won't talk to you before that, unless you tune into the JPC webinar at noon on Thursday, where we're doing Syria, another one of those places where it's very hard to find a happy concluding thought. Eugene Kantorovich, thank you for an outstanding presentation, teaching us a tremendous amount. I want to take one of your law classes
Thank you.
at George Mason. Thank you, and Chag Sameach to you and your family as well.
Hugs, Mark, and hugs, Mark, to everyone in the audience. Take care.